Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Schechtman. In the debate about shootings and violence in America, the debate quickly turns to the availability of guns. And of course, that may be a factor. But what if there is something else, something that we don't like to talk about, that there is a strain in the very culture of America that accepts violence and even homicide as a way of solving problems? After all, didn't the president tell the Secretary of State just last week not to waste his time talking and engaging in diplomacy, and that we have other means? And if such an approach is accepted policy for the conduct of governments and of foreign affairs, as it often has been, then is it any wonder that it becomes the policy of our streets? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Lori Calhoun. She's a philosopher and cultural critic. She's the author of the book, We Kill Because We Can, From Soldiering to Assassination in the Drone Age. She's also published a book on metaphilosophy and dozens of essays. She published one of the first essays critical of targeted killing, and she has participated in an international project group sponsored by the Japan Foundation to develop new approaches to human security and peace building. She holds degrees in chemistry and philosophy from the University of Colorado and Princeton, and it is my pleasure to welcome Lori Calhoun here to Radio Who, What, Why. Lori, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Well, it doesn't seem so on the surface. You argue that there really is some kind of direct link between how we conduct our foreign policy and the kind of violence we're seeing on the streets of America, even as it relates to those incidents of mass shooting as we've seen this week.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's an explanation for people like Mika Xavier Johnson, you know, slaughtering a handful of Dallas policemen. You know, he's been taught that you kill people. There's an injustice. Okay, so he was angry about blacks being killed by police, so he goes and kills a bunch of policemen. So these people are being taught this, that this is what you do. And so it's really not that surprising. In cases like the most recent guy, Stephen Paddock, I mean, who knows exactly what went on there. But there's definitely this association of killing with masculinity and with strength and this concept of justice as well, which is all intertwined with our view on foreign policy.
Quite a while ago, you got interested in this whole idea of drone warfare, particularly as something that you saw as antithetical to democracy. Let's talk about that.
Okay, sure. The very first time I began thinking about this was the first time I learned of a drone strike, which was the November 3rd, 2002 strike in Yemen. And I was shocked when I saw it broadcast on television because all the pundits seemed to be acting like, oh, this is a great thing. And it struck me that, in fact, it is the opposite of democracy because it throws all of our notions of procedural justice out the window. These people were said to be suspected terrorists, and they were taken out by drone at the behest of the U.S. government with no judicial process whatsoever. And so my immediate reaction was, in looking at the aftermath, you know, it was a mangled car, big pile of metal, and the people were incinerated, so there was just dust among the sand. You really couldn't even tell who the people were. And it struck me that this was a very dangerous way for our government to be prosecuting war. We weren't even at war in Yemen at the time. And so it was clearly an act of mass assassination. And yet no one really talked about it much except in terms of the technology. People were very impressed. You can push a button over here and kill people over there. That seemed like a good thing to military folks because that way you could supposedly spare the lives of soldiers. But then nothing was much said about drones for a number of years because as the drone program developed, it became the CIA's program, and because the CIA's activities are covert, there was no discussion of it. There was no acknowledgement of the drone strikes, and much less discussion. And as a result, there was really no public debate about whether this is something we should be doing. Obama finally revealed in 2012 that, in fact, he was killing people with drones. And after that, there was, you know, a little bit more talk about it. But even when Obama killed U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki in 2011, there wasn't that much of an uproar over it, even though it was a clear violation of his civil rights. So even if you want to say that these are tools of war to be used against execrable enemies. Al-Awlaki was a U.S. citizen, and his civil rights were denied in the strike that took his life. So it shows that we have stepped onto this path where the end goal appears to be the elimination of any sort of threat at any cost, even the cost of our civil liberties, which is a very disturbing trend.
How is the drone strike, in your view, different than targeted bombing, for example?
Well, for one thing, the drone strikes have been carried out outside areas of active hostility. So that means that the CIA has conducted hundreds of strikes against people in their own civil societies in places where there are no U.S. soldiers on the ground. So what's happening is it's an expansion of the battlefield in one sense, because they want to say that when mistakes are made, it's collateral damage. But in another sense, it's just an extension of assassination. It's rebranding assassination as targeted killing and calling it an act of war, because the implement of homicide is a missile instead of a pistol or a poison or strangulation wire, whatever assassins usually use to kill people. And so it's a very shocking development, because Obama decided that he could eliminate people using missiles anywhere he found them. It didn't matter if they were in a war zone or not. And he did this, quite a bit, killed thousands of people using these missiles, and, you know, claimed that he was able to do it because of the authorization for use of military force granted to George W. Bush in the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. So that was in 2001, and, you know, the authorization was to be able to pursue the perpetrators of the attacks on 911. And Obama took this as license to be able to kill people anywhere he wanted to. So he used drones to kill people in places where, as I said, there were no U.S. soldiers on the ground, in Yemen, Somalia, and it has continued to spread.
Why do you think that there's been so little relative attention paid to this and so little pushback to it?
The primary reason I find is that the program was covert for so long that no one talked about it. And by the time it was made public, people had already come to accept it as a standard operating procedure. And by people, I mean all of the quote-unquote experts in the military and intelligence agencies. They just viewed this as another tool. And there was no public debate. It's the use of drones to kill suspects is politically palatable, because legislators can say, oh, look, we're keeping the homeland safe and we're not sacrificing your sons and daughters. So it's very appealing to politicians to be able to say, look how strong I am on defense, and yet I'm not harming any of our citizens in doing this. In fact, we're avoiding this. The problem is that the risk that is avoided by using drones instead of armed combat aerial vehicles with real pilots is that the risk is being transferred to the people on the ground. I mean, what's happened is there's not an elimination of risk. The risk is transferred from uniformed soldiers to civilians on the ground who are being killed. And unfortunately, our media don't cover these cases. So what we get in the media, in mainstream media, for the most part, are headlines that say six suspected terrorists slain, and everyone cheers and says, oh, good, they're keeping us safe. But when you dive into the details of these cases, you find that there is inevitably collateral damage. In many cases, the people targeted ended up not being the same people who were killed. Some of the targets sought by the CIA were reportedly killed in the newspaper multiple times. So the question is, who are these people who were killed in their stead with all these other strikes? And those people were, of course, human beings. And they're written off as enemy killed in action, even when their names aren't known. And the assumption is, oh, well, they were in the place where we thought that this suspect would be, so they're obviously an associate, so it's obviously a bad guy too. But this is a very, very slippery slope. When you start assassinating people who happen to be in the same vicinity as someone whom you believe to be dangerous, you know, you've entered into a very murky territory, both morally and legally.
Of course, part of the argument, the irony in this, is that part of the argument is that the drone strikes are supposed to provide less collateral, civilian collateral damage than some kind of aerial bombardment.
Well, they say that, and it is true that a Hellfire missile is less destructive than, you know, Tomahawk. So that's one of the selling points, supposedly. But the problem is that these missiles are being fired on people living in civil society. So imagine your own neighborhood, right? So suppose that the powers that be, it would actually be a foreign government. A foreign government decides someone who is their enemy lives in the house next door and takes out that person. You know, what's left behind is a crater. So the person used to live there. You had no idea he was an enemy of, you know, the other nation, and now he's gone. Now, the question is, what's the effect on you? Well, you could say, well, I'm a good guy, so no one's ever going to try to kill me. But the problem is that you have no idea whether you are going to die in these strikes. When you see these lethal drones hovering above your head, you have no idea whether you're going to be the next one to die, because there's no warning given to these people, so they're not allowed to surrender, and there's no evidence ever presented. So we really, like, the data that these strikes are based on include things like cell phone data, SIM card data, and visuals taken from drone footage. So it's a lot of looks like a terrorist, acts like a terrorist, walks like a terrorist, probably is a terrorist, but maybe it's not a terrorist. So the problem is the United States is killing these people on suspicion and using only really circumstantial evidence. There's no rigor to this at all. It's more like, how can we use this data to hunt down and kill people so that we can, you know, meet certain quotas? But the fact is that we've been given no reason for believing that these people pose direct threats to us way over here. And I think that if any other nation did that on our soil, there would be a huge outcry against it. It would be incredibly stressful to know that, you know, missiles flying above you are going to be killing people in your neighborhood. And yet, because Americans have no idea what the reality of this is psychologically, they have just blithely accepted it as a part of the war on terror.
Not only accepted it, but you argue that there's kind of a cultural proclivity towards it.
Well, I think it is a big cultural problem. And this brings us back to the question of guns, why people are so shocked when people open fire on crowds. I mean, we have an entire culture of killing in this country where we have video games, you know, that in fact, people sit and play, and the aim of the games, I've never played any of these, but I've been invited many times on my Kindle to go play Mobile Strike. So people, you know, a pastime of people is, you know, hunting down and killing people using these applications, some of which may have been developed by the DOD to get new recruits for their drone program. In fact, I would be very surprised if they weren't. But we do have this sort of macho association of killing with strength. And so this is why leaders always say all options are on the table whenever there's any sort of international dispute, which means, of course, that they're willing to go to war. So rather than thinking that that's a sign of weakness, that you're incapable of persuading the person who disagrees with you that they need to change their behavior or do something different or acknowledge something that is wrong, you're just going to wipe them off the face of the planet. And this is why I don't find it that surprising when we have these mass killings, because what people are taught in this country is that that's how to resolve conflict. Now, when you look at the individual cases of these mass killings, for example, the most recent one in Las Vegas, there are always other details, you know, that come out. For example, this guy was on anti-anxiety meds, as were most of the mass shooters in recent history. And this sort of factor is brushed aside because the big pharma lobby is every bit as strong as the NRA lobby. So you end up with the same old debate about guns. You know, did the guns cause him to do this? No, of course not. Did the drug alone cause him to do this? No, of course not. But there's a whole cultural apparatus involved as well, which is our view about violence, that this is what we do. We go kill people when there's a problem.
And is it your sense that that culture, that sense of looking towards violence as a solution to a problem, is uniquely American in some respects?
It's very American. I wouldn't say that it's uniquely American, but it it has a lot to do with the I want to say the benefit of the doubt that people give to the military. So, for example, as you know, many people revile Donald Trump, and yet when the Congress is brought to decide whether the AUMF for 2001 should stand, they just tabled Senator Rand Paul's motion and said, no, we'll just like leave it standing. So they're allowing the AUMF to be used by Trump, even though the Democrats say that in other contexts, they say things like he should be impeached. So they're giving him these war powers. And then when he approaches them with an increase in the defense budget from $600 billion to $700 billion with an $80 billion increase, you know, that passes as well. Even though on the one hand they say, oh, you know, Trump is a madman, he can't be trusted, and yet they're giving him these enormous war powers and even more money to spend in wars. So we have this presumption in America that the military is by definition good because it's defending us. But when you look at the actual effects of our military incursions, at least over the course of the 21st century, you see that, in fact, it doesn't look like we're becoming more safe. And the argument for that is that the global war on terror keeps expanding to new countries. So it, from a handful of radical jihadists at the time of the attacks of September 11th, 2001, we now have thousands of these people, and new franchises such as ISIS are always popping up and spreading. And so when you look at the effects of the actual military practices and policies, the arming of the moderate rebels in Syria, for example, which led to a massive expansion of ISIS across both Syria and Iraq, you find that in reality, though the military may have good intentions to keep us safe and to defend the homeland, it doesn't look like they're actually accomplishing that at all. And yet there's this reflexive presumption on the part of Americans and politicians to support anything that's called defense, rather than examining, is this in fact a case of defense? Are we being defended by these policies and practices? That you just call it defense and automatically people will sign on to it.
I mean, I guess the broader philosophical question is how we view warfare itself, whether we view warfare and militarism as a tool of diplomacy or whether diplomacy becomes an extension of warfare by other means.
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, it used to be thought that you have to exhaust all diplomatic means before resorting to war. The whole paradigm of counterterrorism in the 21st century has thrown a wrench into that view, into the works, because it is said that these radical jihadists cannot be negotiated with. There's no one to negotiate with. There's no state. You can't talk to these people. They're unreasonable. But in reality, when you look at what some of these people have said, including Osama bin Laden, they are protesting U.S. foreign policy. And, for example, the 1991 Gulf War and its aftermath, in which 500,000 children died as a result of draconian sanctions imposed after the U.S. military had destroyed their water treatment facilities. So they actually have, if you will listen to them, these people have in some cases valid complaints, which is not to condone what they do or to say that their response is somehow warranted. It's certainly not. But the point is they have these grievances, they air them, we ignore them, and we go ahead and do the same thing over and again, and then we wonder why the number of terrorists continues to multiply when they're all saying the same thing. Unfortunately, under George W. Bush, you know, this sort of trope, they hate us for our freedom, became very popular. And that came to be the governing view of why, you know, we have to eradicate all of these people from the planet because they're just so evil intrinsically. But the problem now is we're killing adolescents. We're killing teenagers, young men who were small children at the time of 9/11. They had nothing to do with 9/11. And they're reacting to the killing, the slaughter of Muslims in their countries all over the Middle East. These people are popping up all over the place in Western Europe, in the United States, and, you know, continuing these drone campaigns and these mass bombing campaigns throughout the Middle East is doing nothing to, it can't do anything to stem the tide of angry people in the West who are going to rise up in retaliation.
In many ways, it's this culture that we were talking about earlier coming back to haunt us, because in many cases this terrorist culture is very much the same as this American culture we talked about earlier.
That's absolutely right. It's the call to jihad is very similar to this call for just war. And what I find really ironic about the drone age is that we're now using these drones in very similar ways to which the terrorists used airplanes on September 11th, right? So there's no warning given. They fire without any sort of indication of, you know, who the target is or why this person has been thought to need to be eliminated. I mean, it's a very similar paradigm. It's almost as though we've been remade in the image of these terrorists because we're doing precisely what they did. There's no announcement, there's no warning, there's no provision of the possibility of surrender. It's exactly like the people who died in the Twin Towers. These people had no idea what was coming. It was awful what was done. And yet we seem to be doing something not unlike that with these drone campaigns in other people's civil societies. And it's really unfortunate. I agree with you that in both cases, there's this idea that somehow killing is the way to accomplish something. But in fact, killing is just killing. Homicide is a tactic. It's not a strategy. It doesn't achieve anything but the elimination of your enemy. And it doesn't change anyone's view. If anything, it causes more people to be radicalized, as we saw in response to all of the war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also in Guantanamo Bay. I mean, we know what the reaction to that was. It was anger, it was outrage, and it was a proliferation of terrorism, not its stanching.
What has happened, in your view, to the idea of diplomacy? It is a concept that in so many ways has gotten lost in this cultural landscape that we talked about.
It's really unfortunate. People in America seem to think that people think, that voters think, that diplomacy is concessional. It's a form of weakness, right? It's a willingness to back down. So you have these macho standoffs between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. You know, they're both willing to fire their missiles, flex their muscles and fire their missiles. And the idea that, you know, maybe we should just sit down at a table and have a talk, that's considered weak. And it's really unfortunate because I believe that it's exactly the opposite. The tyrant is the person who can't persuade people to see things his way, and so he has to chop off their heads. And that's what we've come to at this point. Instead of trying to bring people around, you know, the old idea, win hearts and minds and, you know, persuade people, that's really gone to the wayside. And the excuse is, oh, you can't, again, reason with any of these people. But this is just false. I mean, these people are the ones who are emerging now, the foot soldiers. They're teenagers one day. They're proselytized into this ISIS cult the next day, and then suddenly they're evil enemy number two. I mean, the truth is that these people, if they could be persuaded to fight for the ISIS cause, they could be persuaded that they were mistaken in having made that choice. And there have been a few people who have unconverted. But most of them aren't given the choice. They're just slaughtered. And this is a crisis. I mean, this is really a tragedy for humanity, in my view. I mean, we're killing some of these people who really have morally righteous reasons for rising up against their central government authority or for being outraged by the invaders of their own land. So they rise up, they join, unfortunately, a gang, which is what ISIS is, and then they're killed. And so I really feel like this is an incredibly nihilistic approach to conflict in the Middle East. And I don't really see how this can end well. I mean, it just seems to keep expanding. The administration never seems to realize that the fact that the global war on terrorism continues to expand reveals that the tactics they've been using don't work. Instead, they just figure we can just keep building more missiles and drones and killing more people until the end of time. And this is a very unfortunate turn in history where diplomacy no longer seems to play a role because we've made lethality the be-all and end-all of our foreign policy, which is very unfortunate.
Can we find a tipping point for this? When we got to this point where we view diplomacy in the way you've been talking about?
I think it had a lot to do with just the terrorist attacks, okay? So it became I mean, I suppose it went a little farther back. In 1991 or 1990, in the buildup before Desert Storm, the 1991 Gulf War, George H.W. Bush announced, we will not negotiate, right? So that was perhaps the turning point where we started having this very muscular view about foreign policy. George H.W. Bush bragged about the fact that he had beaten the Vietnam syndrome. Well, the Vietnam syndrome was a hesitation to go to war, and with good reason. Why would you want to go to war and slaughter millions of people, you know, 50,000 of your own soldiers for nothing, really, in effect, is what happened in Vietnam. But George H.W. Bush, he kind of turned things around in his view and made us more of a bellicose nation, willing to go out there and fight these wars in the name of justice. And that was perhaps the turning point, because it was only after we invaded Iraq in 1991 that Al-Qaeda emerged and became intent on fighting back. So that may have been the turning point. And then, you know, when you see these ISIS gang members doing these horrific beheadings and drowning people in cages, of course, that just gets people's emotions going. And it seems to confirm the idea that they can't be reasoned with and that nothing can be done but to erase them from the face of the planet. But I want to come back again to the fact that the people who join these groups are becoming younger and younger, and at some point it's just going to be children. And this is just a human tragedy, to be wiping out all of these impressionable children who have been persuaded by gangs to join up and try to kill people.
And what is it going to take, in your view, for this to begin to even begin to turn around?
I think we need to have an international outcry, and it may be that the glass half full on the more pro-military approach of Trump, we'll see how this goes, will be that the international community will finally rise up and say, no, we're not going to be your poodle, we're not going to go along with this, that maybe they will finally come to the conclusion that align themselves with the United States wherever they want to kill people, whenever they want to kill people, for whatever reason they say they want to kill people, is no longer a good idea. And once that happens, then the United States will be viewed as an isolated rogue state rather than the beacon of freedom and the leader of the free world, as it always claims to be. You know, one example I could give here is Trump's calling out Venezuela. This seems to be completely unprovoked and threatening them in various ways. This sort of behavior could lead to a turning point where people start to examine our policies and our practices and say, hey, wait a minute, is it really okay for the United States to kill anyone they want, anywhere they want, using missiles? It's possible that this could happen. Unfortunately, under Barack Obama, he was so soft-spoken and everyone liked him, and so no one really thought of him as a dangerous person. But lots of people think that Donald Trump is a dangerous person. Barack Obama's policies were very dangerous because all of the executive authority he assumed in, for example, assassinating U.S. citizens without indictment, much less trial, have been transferred now to Trump. So Trump now has all the power that Obama assumed. And in Trump's hands, it may be viewed as more dangerous than it was in the case of Obama, particularly as he expands the drone program. It looks like they're going to, you know, start delivering missiles to other countries beyond the seven that are already being bombed. And, you know, there will be a point, I believe, where the international community finally says enough is enough. You know, we don't want any part of this. I'm not sure when that will happen, but it could be precipitated by the presidency of Donald Trump. It's kind of sad that my silver lining on the Trump cloud is that he may actually drive the international community to abandon the United States. But I think that's actually the only way out of this. We can't have more nations agreeing to follow the example of Barack Obama, as David Cameron did in the UK by executing two of his own British compatriots in Syria, even though the death penalty is outlawed in Britain. So we can't have more, we certainly can't have more people following the example of Donald Trump. I mean, that would be a complete disaster. And so what I'm hoping is that there will be some pullback, and that maybe, even though we don't have a very strong anti-war movement in this country, maybe other countries will finally find their own voice rather than just echoing whatever the United States says. I mean, I really think we've extended our political capital from World War II by now. You know, if you look at everything we've done since World War II, it's pretty ghastly. I mean, look at Vietnam, look at the 1991 Gulf War, you know, it just goes on and on. And okay, so maybe we were the good guys in some sense in World War II, but that was a long time ago.
Lori Calhoun, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.